Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Bernadine Sung Magazine with Compass Real Estate, serving buyers and sellers throughout Greater Boston. Learn more at homesbybernadine.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan. Tomorrow, by the way, we are back at the Boston Public Library. I hope you are too. John Waters, among others, and he is one of the great guests of all time. For 100 years, Haribo's Gold Bears have been getting stuck in the back of our teeth, delighting children and adults. I should say delighting children and some adults in their chewy stickiness. But gummies have grown to become a cultural phenomenon as well, used everywhere from sushi to pot. Joining us now on Zoom to discuss is Corby Kummer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program. That's at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at the Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hey there, Corby.
Hello.
Well,
Corby Kummer, before we get back to the increasing importance of gummies in our lives, Jim Brown, I noticed a couple of weeks ago, was telling me about how he had adopted this new brilliant cure-all for any kind of weight management, the time-restricted eating diet.
Once again, by the way, something I told you in total confidence for the four millionth time. Go ahead.
I noticed Jim comes in every day with like seven little containers of Tupperware, little vegetables and rice
else.
And everything. And then I noticed that he's wolfing down his Tupperware containers like at 9 o'clock in the morning. I said, Jim, I thought you were doing the 11 to 8 restricted diet. And I guess Jim was ahead of his time. It's a bunch of bunk, the time-restricted diet. Didn't work for you, Jim?
Jim reads my Twitter feed.
What'd you say exactly? I forget.
There's very depressing news for intermittent fasting people. It doesn't make a difference when you eat calories. You're not going to lose or gain more weight. It really is calories in, calories out. This was, you know, there.
Sorry,
been...
Jim. Sorry.
Hey, Marjorie, you've said enough, I think, on this topic.
Wait, there's defense for it. So
good.
Happy at the end of this discussion. First, there was a really interesting study that was for more than a year, and Ethan Weiss, a diet researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, says there's absolutely no benefit to eating in a time-restricted window. Nonetheless, he was an evangelist for time-restricted eating. He would only eat between noon and 8 p.m. His family had a hard time accepting this, and he had a hard time accepting the data and asked his statisticians to analyze the data of 116 adult participants, three meals a day, complete recording of everything they ate, whether it was between noon and eight or all day, all night long. And after four times, the data statisticians said, the results are not going to change. It just doesn't make a difference about weight loss. And he really didn't want to accept this, but now he's eating breakfast and saying his family says,
can I tell you, the thing is ridiculous. I mean, first of all, if you stop eating, I did 11 to 8 for a short period of time, and I told, as I say, Marjorie in confidence, and I appreciate that. And when you don't...
You haven't learned this lesson yet, Jim.
Excuse me. When you don't eat from 8 till bedtime, it seems to me that he's not challenging the notion that if you eat right before bedtime, that's not good because you don't get to metabolize or whatever. So I don't get these. Now, it is true, in all fairness, I didn't share this with Marjorie. When I stopped eating at 8, I occasionally passed out on the floor at about 9:10. I had to be usually picked up by a group of people to put me back on the couch.
So there's reasons not to go horizontal right after you eat a meal.
I'm not buying this.
All kinds of things about your gastric system, but it's calories in, calories out. And so there's still a role for Jim's diet. There's still a role for Dr. Ethan Weiss's diet, which is it's an easy, handy way of restricting calories.
Well, go ahead, Corby.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I've noticed just in my own life, I'm not usually very hungry in the morning, so I eat breakfast later in the morning. But if you don't, if I notice that for whatever reason I don't eat enough dinner the night before, I get up in the morning really hungry. And it makes sense, right? Because you didn't eat your usual amount of food at 7 o'clock. You get up at 7 o'clock, you're hungry. So that does seem to make sense. It is the calories that you have in your body metabolized, I guess.
Right. And this is why Dr. Weiss's family says that now that he eats breakfast, he's a lot nicer guy, because he needed to eat in the morning. But everybody has to find different ways of figuring out how to restrict their calories during a day if they are trying to lose weight. And the time restricted way is a perfectly fine way, unless, Jim, you wind up supine 1 hour later and you know you're completely out of it. You can't. You have to judge for yourself, but it's the number of calories that matter.
You know, by the way, I had lunch with Dr. Weiss last year. He weighed 150. He's 290 now. So they went off the intermittent fasting diet. What, Marjorie?
Corby, Jim didn't want me to reveal this, but it wasn't a group of people that put him back on the couch. He had to call the firefighters in Cambridge, all six of them.
I said a group of people. I didn't say who those people were. We're talking to Corby Cummer.
Okay, Corby Cummer. Let's move on to something else. I already said here it is. The thing about, we have heard this forever, that these food deserts, and that one of the problems was that there was no fresh food in neighborhoods, and that would solve a part of the problem of people just running to the 7-Eleven or the nearby McDonald's to eat. This seems to have been undermined.
You know, there's lots of problems with that. And considering that all of us right-minded nutrition and food people think that access to fresh food and making it affordable is the be-all and end-all, it's certainly a very great thing. And the 2.5 years that we spent at Food and Society at the Aspen Institute on a Food as Medicine research action plan came through with the same results that a really insightful sociologist named Kenneth Cobb in South Carolina in his new book, Retail Inequality, came up with, which is you don't tell a community what they should be eating. You, if they're underserved and they don't have access to a lot of basic services, you ask them, what is it that you need? And often it's better public transport. For example, to get to a supermarket, it's investment in the community. You can't go in and just impose a diet on them because you think it's going to be a better diet and that they're going to want fresh food. So one of the insights of his book, Retail Inequality, is what people want is investments in their community. They don't want to be told how to change what they eat.
Can I say one? First of all, I'm a little embarrassed that we need Kenneth Kolb to explain this to us, because it's like almost every single issue. Like, for example, we had earlier today, we were talking to Michael Curry, who was the chair of this health equity thing on the state level. And he made the point, as has been made a million times, it's not just about improving health care for low-income people and people of color. It's also all the social determinants. And what Kolb seems to be saying is if you're going to try to fix the health via diet of somebody in an underserved community, you can't just give them a grocery store. You have to give them other things so the neighborhood is fuller and richer and that. Yeah. I mean, that is his basic point,
but
is it not?
The important thing is that so many of us got this wrong for years.
You're right about that.
We've been talking about
food deserts.
If only you could get to the Star Market or the Stop and Shop, there wouldn't be this problem. And we were just wrong.
Is that it wasn't enough. Not that they don't need those stores, but that the stores alone are not enough. Is that not the point?
Exactly. That's it. There's nothing wrong with giving people double value food coupons, pioneered by Boston's and Massachusetts' own Gus Schumacher, enshrined in national law as the Gus Nip double value food, fresh fruit and vegetable SNAP benefit. That's all fantastic to give people more food, but it's not enough. Just putting it in front of them doesn't mean that they have the education, the time to use it, or the desire to use it. So Jim has gotten the religion about social determinants of health. That is what you always have to think of when you're trying to improve people's diets and their health in any community. And one of the things Cobb says is really kind of hits us all where we live, which is spending so much time talking about fruits and vegetables can also be a way to sidestep tougher conversations about racism and poverty.
Yeah.
So, Corby Cummer, I want to do this briefly because it's so horrible. These 5 million chickens were executed by this chicken company in the most gruesome of fashion, essentially getting rid of their air supply. And it's
disgusting.
Horrible story. But I have two questions. I mean, the first thing is we really should stop eating these things. I mean, I'm really embarrassed by it, and it's horrible. But beyond that fact, in the story that was in The Guardian, they talk about there was one case of avian flu. Avian flu. And they killed 5 million chickens to essentially stem its spread. Is that the beyond the gruesome way in which they killed these chickens, do you have to kill all of the animals in close contact to avian flu to control avian flu? Is there no other way to do this or what? By the way, Rembrandt is the name of the company, and the guy who owns it owns the Minnesota Timberwolves. So Rudy, oh, they're out of the playoffs. But if they weren't out of the playoffs, root against them. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Corby.
It's because of the proximity. So one way to prevent this mass slaughter would be to prevent factory farming and concentrated animal feedlot operations. So it is a real mystery why, if there's swine flu in China, one pig infected 30 million. Last year, I think it was 30 million pigs in China slaughtered. Wow. And now we're seeing 5 million chicken slaughtered. It's because it goes through the air. They're in this horrible 12 birds per tiny coop,
horrible
factory conditions, and there's no way of stopping it except to kill them because of this incredible proximity, which is so against nature and against the way of raising animals. So two things going on in this story: the incredible inhumanity and Holocaust conditions of sucking the air out and then roasting them alive, extreme suffering, and they collapse and die from heat and suffocation, and they suffer. And even the factory people say, yeah, they suffer a lot, but it's the quickest way of doing it, and it's the most efficient way. But aside from the Holocaust literal horror of the mass slaughter of these birds, the people who had to one by one remove these birds over about 2 months, I think 6 weeks, after this horrible, gruesome, PTSD-inducing, health kind of threatening removal of these dead birds and then burning them in trenches, again, the Holocaust comparisons, they come to a meeting and 250 of them are handed yellow envelopes. Yeah. And a guy, the worker representative, says, we were told to attend a meeting. We walked in, big stack of yellow envelopes. That's like showing a knife to a chicken. You know what's going to happen next. We worked ourselves out of a job. People with years of experience, horrible, just let go. 250 employees who'd been miserably treated and this nightmare that will haunt them the rest of their lives lost their jobs.
We're trying
May I ask you one quick question, Corby? Where are we overall in factory farming in the United States? I mean, how much and how effective?
Remember that ballot question in Massachusetts that got modified in terms of space for the chickens and the whatevers?
Yeah, well, we did do something, right?
Something we did
in Massachusetts. But what is the state across the country? Is it just kind of going on as ever, undaunted?
We're completely reliant on it. McDonald's and other large companies, McDonald's, the big bad fast food company, has greatly improved animal welfare, especially for chickens and for pigs and no docking of tails. For chickens in cage-free, starting in California, and then it went across the country. So there have been improvements in it, but the factory farm system for eggs and chicken is still going strong. For beef is kind of the worst in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, and especially for concentrated animal feedlot operations.
So if you want to avoid, if you still want to eat chicken and buy eggs and avoid these factory farm purveyors, what do you do?
Look for the Animal Welfare Institute seal or any kind of animal welfare. Whole Foods subsumed it and put in their own standards. So it's not so good when a company gets to define its own welfare standards, but at least it's something. At least it's trying to commit to it. Look for some kind of welfare standard seal on the back.
Okay. So I want to do this briefly because we've discussed tipping ad nauseum, but there's a piece by this Ashley Wells in Grub Street, who's a restaurant tour with her husband, owns a restaurant or something, responding to a tipping fatigue piece, which we read. And the thing that I wanted to focus on, I had no idea, and I'm embarrassed that I never asked you in particular. I had, and she's obviously making the case that you got to take care of these people. Even we restaurateurs who pay our people well can't pay them well enough for them to live decent lives unless you supplement their income, which is the tradition in this country, at least. I had no idea what that service fee that appeared on the check in most restaurants during the pandemic was. I'm a pretty good tipper. It's horrible to say about yourself, but that's one of the few things I do well. How, and I don't include that. I think a lot of people
thought it was a tip.
Exactly. It was part of the tip. And
I'm
she
mortified.
Says
I'm mortified.
It's for it's a supplement for labor and operating costs. They should say that on the damn check if they're so concerned about the workers.
Because I've gone out to a couple of places that had 18% added, and I stupidly assumed it was a tip. And
well,
then
sometimes
I
it is, but if it says
I
service
didn't know.
Fee,
and
it's
so
not.
Instead of giving a usual 20%, I gave a lot less, and I feel like a real creep.
So what's the deal?
It's not stupid. Some states have rules by which tips cannot be shared with back of the house people who are not in contact with the customers. And so this was a way of passing wages on to back of the house dishwashers and cooks and line cooks. And it's really important to have this kind of service charge because otherwise sharkish lawyers will round up service people, as in waiters, and say, you know, you've been forced to share and pool your tips with back of the house people who are not allowed by state laws to get tips. And so we're going to sue Mario Batali and others. They were high profile lawsuits of stolen tips, but they weren't really stolen tips. Sometimes they were. They were plowed right into rent and all things that should not have been plowed into. Other times they were going back to the back of house workers who weren't allowed to get tips. So it's a good thing, but sadly, you probably have to ask, who's it going to? Another important thing about the service charges is it's taxes revenue. And everything you should know about the tips that you ever leave that are not actually cash on the table are taxes revenue. I think that's probably a good thing, but I don't think that most customers understand it doesn't go straight into the server's pocket.
So, Corby Cummer, I'm going to play something to really uplift everybody who's listening to this conversation. Here's the theme of the great 1980s Disney cartoon, Adventures of the Gummy Bears. Take it away.
Gummy bears bouncing here and there and everywhere. High invention that's beyond compare. They are the gummy bears.
By the way, most people I know who know what they're talking about, which is most people I know, think that Godfather and Adventures of the Gummy Bears are two of the finest from the last 50 years. Do you like that film in particular, Corby, or no?
I love anything that markets sugar to children and gives them a friendly
So what is it? There's a big story in the New York Times, but what is it, the 100th anniversary of the gummy bear from this Haribo company? Where is it, in Germany or some such thing? I find there is nothing appealing. It's like a peep to me. I know we have difference of opinion on peeps. What is the fascination with it? And somebody in the story said it's the largest selling candy form in the world. Is that true, or she's just...
You know, I haven't looked at this. There's a number of shocking statistics in the New York Times. So after all, they must be true.
It's must be
the
true,
New York
of course.
Times. Which is it's the most popular selling candies. I think it became popular in the 1990s. Better for you gummies. There are all kinds of adult variations to make gummies seemingly more healthy. And that now it's really taken off. It wasn't until the 1980s that it took off here. And then that film you just played, and you're reinforcing marketing to children. I hope you feel
good. The gummy bears, yeah.
$4.6 billion market for gummies in 2021, 15% increase over the previous year. So they are ridiculously popular, and they were built with slave labor by the Germans in the 1930s. So Haribo used slave labor.
Oh, Haribo, I said it wrong.
40, so I hope that you feel really bad about your previous love of gummies.
I never loved gummies. That's just not true. I am proud for the wrong reasons, but I never liked gummies.
I knew that people put THC in gummies because that's one of the things they sell at all the pot stores. I didn't know they put liquor inside gummies, small shots of cocktails.
Yeah, you bite into it and it explodes in your mouth. You've had those. Yeah.
No, I haven't.
You haven't?
No.
Figure
I've had the marijuana ones.
So this is one of the This is one of the mysteries of dealing with young people, which is endlessly rewarding, mm-hmm. is their relentless love of gummies. And I fear that it went back to that very Disney movie you played the theme of.
Adventures of the Gummy Bears. Can we hear that again, please, by the way? Here it is. Adventures, the theme. Good. Take it quiet, you two,
so
for a second.
Catchy.
Wait, please. Pretty, that's a decent theme song.
I love it.
Let's acknowledge that. I'm sorry, Corby, you were saying something?
No, it's the idea of the effectiveness of marketing that is so startling. Also, there's something about, you know, it's like chewing gum. There's something about something, what does one of the candy analysts call it? Mouth persistence, where you get to keep chewing it and there's something satisfying about it. It may elude us, except margarine and pot store.
Yeah.
But,
that's ever, right.
So, but it seems to be a good delivery vehicle.
So, Corby, before you go, I really have to spend a moment on butter basted burgers that Gordon Ramsay is going to be bringing to the Canopy by Hilton Hotel later this year. What are butter basted burgers?
And what is the Canopy by Hilton Hotel? That's
exactly.
The other thing.
And where is 111 North Street?
That's I had all the same questions you did.
I don't know where that
These
is.
These are all local,
is that
by the
North
way.
North End?
All right, so I'm almost certain it's in the North End by the waterfront.
Oh, okay.
We've passed these buildings in the past, and Gordon Ramsay's TV fame is bringing him, it's not a Planet Hollywood burger, but he's got two restaurants here, and it's going to be Ramsay's. He has Ramsay's Kitchen in the Mandarin Oriental in Back Bay. I mean, Beef Wellington by Gordon Ramsay, and in the Back Bay, it's kind of makes your head explode. And now we've got burgers, Hell's Kitchen burgers. He makes them local. The point is, it's TV starting that translates into big deals and investment money behind somebody national who comes in, and a big national chain like the Hilton thinks that he'll bring in tourists and customers.
Before you go away, why did you mock? I love Beef Wellington. I've actually made Beef Wellington, and I've done it nicely, if I say so myself. Mm-hmm. Why were you mocking that his restaurant at the Mandarin has Beef Wellington?
I don't mock any Beef Wellington ever, and it is a great party dish, especially if you grew up with Julia Child and you like making puff pastry at home, as I hope you do, Jim Browden. You didn't buy the puff pastry in a Pepperidge Farm box.
I can't remember what I did.
Yeah, you can't remember. You're unable to recall at this moment in time. It's a wonderful dish, and to have access to these classic dishes, any place that does it is great. I'm sorry that it's some TV star who trumps up his bad temper to get these deals, and I wish it was a local place like L'Espalier, or someplace that tried really fine dining and beautiful service, and wasn't that at the Mandarin Oriental? And maybe this is in the very space that L'Espalier occupied. So I would so much rather it be somebody local. I'm all for fine dining and having access to these dishes wherever they do it, and somebody who gives local employment.
Good for you.
Yeah, that's a good point. You don't really think, because the Mandarin Oriental is a beautiful hotel.
It is,
top of the line. Gordon Ramsay, you're saying, is not really considered a top-of-the-line chef.
Oh, did I say that?
No,
I
said exactly.
National TV stardom, and whoever he hires here is the person who's going to set the standards for that restaurant.
Okay. What is a butter-based burger,
please?
We got to
go, Marjorie.
Please?
You cook it in butter, and then you use the butter, you baste it with it. Yeah, I've done that. I mean, what's
really?
The big deal?
Is that what it is?
People do it in lard and beef fat as well, you should know.
Okay.
And this is part of what makes burgers good, basting them in fat.
Good for
basting
you,
Basting them in fat, okay.
Okay,
Corby,
thank
you
great
very much.
9 p.m.
Good to see you, Corby. Be well.
Jim has them on speed dial, the firefighters in Cambridge. Corby Cummings.
I felt once or twice I collapsed. Most. Maybe twice.
Corby Cummings.
Maybe three
is
times.
Executive
but very rarely.
Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute. It's not funny. I'm sorry. A senior editor at the Atlantic. Actually, it is kind of funny. And
okay.
A senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Okay. Coming up. Jewish and Muslim groups are concerned about Musk's Twitter takeover. The Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us for that and more on All Revved Up. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.